Open your Bibles to Luke 19. We'll get started tonight in the study of the same story that our youngsters are studying in the classroom next door. Let's talk a little bit about Zacchaeus. Each night we'll try to integrate, at least in the opening of our lesson together, a little bit about what's being studied among the kids. So while you're getting there, let me just express a little bit of thanksgiving. It's my first time to be here. I've never been in the state of North Carolina until about 3 hours ago. So it's been great so far. Everything I've seen so far is good. Barbecue, good. Texas, you know, pretty good also. That's where I'm from. But it was really excellent. And I'm seeing familiar faces, people that I know, and making new friendships already. It just means a lot to me to be here, and I'm thankful for the invite. To the shepherds here, thank you for extending this opportunity, and I take it very seriously, this chance to do some teaching. Luke 19 is a good place to start with Zacchaeus. Everybody knows that except for Jeff, who's here tonight, and he thinks Jesus was short. The rest of us know that Zacchaeus was, in fact, a wee little man. And a wee little man was he, and he climbed up in the sycamore tree because the Lord he wanted to see. And what they'll be studying next door is they'll be studying Zacchaeus, a man who looked for Jesus, who answered the call of Jesus, and who was willing to repent of whatever he needed to in his life in order to be in a relationship with Jesus. And if this was like a Sunday morning of a gospel meeting or something, and there were visitors here from the community or people who are not yet Christians or people who are really kind of new in their faith, then I would probably preach a Zacchaeus sermon today. And I would be like, hey, you need to be like Jesus, or you need to be like Zacchaeus and look for Jesus and follow him. But this is like Friday night of a beginning meeting. Like, I'm looking at a bunch of super Christians tonight. Like, you guys are the A-listers. You're tired after a long work week. You don't even know who I am. Just some Texas guy flew in and you still came. Like, you know your stuff. So I'm not going to waste 40 minutes telling you to climb down the tree and go let Jesus have dinner with you. Instead, I want to show you something else in this story that will dominate a lot of what we do this weekend. Let's pick up in verse 5. Luke 19 and 5, when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house. And he hurried and came down and received Jesus gladly. When they saw it, and you know who they are, they all began to grumble, saying, he has gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, half of my possessions I will give to the poor, and if I've defrauded anyone of anything, I'll give back four times as much. And Jesus said to him, today, salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Okay, A-listing super Christians. I'm not going to convince you tonight to go be more like Zacchaeus. You're already like Zacchaeus. The real import of this story is for you and me to go out and be more like Jesus. Jesus was going about his mission, his day, and he sees one guy up in a tree. He derails the path that he is taking to go speak to one bad guy that most people had rejected. He changes up his schedule and he goes to this one man's house because one soul, one man seeking is worth changing everything in order to captivate and help. He brings salvation to his house. The real contrast in this chapter is between Jesus, who goes to a tax collector, goes to his house, brings salvation to him, and the other guys in verse 7. You know who those were? The scribes and the Pharisees, the law dogs, the ones who knew that they were right. They were pious and holy and saved and preserved. And frankly, they didn't have time for a Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was not important enough to them. Zacchaeus would not serve their interests or their political aspirations. He is a nothing to them. Jesus says, he is everything that I'm here to do. I think God's people need a little more, and by that I mean a lot more Jesus in us. A term that you're going to hear me use throughout the weekend on and off, we get five sessions together, is the term missions of mercy. Jesus was on a mission of mercy. By mission, he knew what he was here to do. He was here not to establish some group that was greater than all the other groups. He was here to seek and to save every single seeking soul one at a time. He lived his entire life on the mission of changing people's lives. And it was a mission of mercy. His entire job was to go share mercy with people. People who were hurting, or in this case, doubting and confused. And he came to give them that one life-giving hope that they've been seeking for their whole lives. And folks, I just need you to know, that's who we need to be. We need to be people who are mission-oriented. You know exactly why you're alive. You guys know you're not alive just to get to heaven, right? Tell me you know that.
Tell me you know
that. Because you're already going to heaven.
So let's get out of here.
I mean, what are you waiting for?
The objective is, let's just be saved, and that's all we're really here to do.
Then let's go home. The reason we're still here, Ephesians 2, verse 10, is because God has work for us to do. Ephesians 2 said, I'm saving you by my grace, verse 8, because you are my workmanship to carry out good works. Folks, please remember this. The work is the people. The work is the Zacchaeus that you work with. The work is the neighbor. The work is the family member. It's the struggling one. We need to be like Jesus and go on missions. But first, you have to know that you're here for the mission. I am still alive to seek and save the lost. Tell yourself that and believe it. You'll be believing it, I think, by the time we're done. I am still alive to seek and save the lost. And it's not a mission of judgment. And it's not a mission of conformity. And it's not a mission of becoming like us and serving our greater interests and some numbers on a board somewhere. Who cares about the numbers on the board? It's a mission of introducing mercy into your life, of telling you that your life has value and that Jesus has died for you and that there's more to life than all the money that you've socked away as a tax collector. Missions of mercy. There's a song in our book. Maybe you'll be willing to take a peek at it. Song number 571. I've been preaching half my life, 20-something years. I've been married for almost 25 years. And my wife said to never lead singing ever anywhere. And certainly not in North Carolina or, well, just anywhere, basically. She didn't say that. So I'm not going to do that, but I would like you to see this song. Do you know it? 571? Seeking the lost. Seeking the lost. Let's just go straight to verse 3 for the sake of time tonight. Thus I would, not Jesus, he already did this. Who sang this song before? Give me a little one of these if you've ever sang this song. So you're on the hook then. I got you right where I want you. You have already publicly confessed to the Lord that you believe these things. I just want to remind you of the vow you have taken. Thus, I would go on missions of mercy, following Christ from day unto day, cheering the faint, raising the fallen, pointing the lost to Jesus the way. And then here's why I like the song. I like bass leads. Going afar. She told me not to do it. I almost did it. But, you know, we like that. It's like, going afar upon the mountain. I know it's awful, but look, we like to sing it. When's the last time, hey, straight up, guys, I just got here, I don't know you, you can't get mad at me. When's the last time you went and climbed a mountain to save a soul? When's the last time you went far to rescue someone from the grips of Satan? Jesus did that all the time. Everything he did was about that. And by the way, everything he's now doing as high priest continues to be servicing the needs of those who need to be saved. We're all like going afar. He's like, what mountain? I'm going to tell you this straight because I'm on the clock. I got to quit at 8. I'm just going to give it to you straight. The future of the church, wherever we may be, is dependent on this. We have got to be more like Jesus, going the distance in the direction to the people who need it. Some of that has to do with church culture. Sometimes it feels like local churches have built like a 6-foot wall around their fellowship with like one ladder with 5 rungs in it. And if you can figure out how to climb that ladder and fall over, then we can be friends. That's not the way it works. Jesus stopped what he was doing. I think probably what he was doing was important. To go hang out with a tax collector in a tree who is 4'9". I have no idea. But he goes to his house. Like, we've got to tear down these 6-foot walls and go. Like, we got to go. You say, well, what do you mean go? Hey, I'll keep it easy. Just one-on-one. You got to go to somebody. Go to anyone. Have one conversation. And we do things at home like inviting people to church and going through material. Hopefully I'll get a chance to talk to some of the elders here about that this weekend. But it really starts with, do I have, and here's my lesson for tonight, like, do I have a heart like Jesus' heart? That's question 101. Because if I don't have a heart like the heart of Jesus, and I've been working really, really hard on this, and I'm preaching it to you because I'm still working on it, But if I have a heart like Jesus, I'm going to want every tool at my disposal that can help me reach someone who's lost. But if I don't have a heart like Jesus, like you could preach on evangelism once a month and it wouldn't do me any good. You can show me like film strips and big picture presentations and gospel message booklets and three promises outlines. It's not going to change me because you can equip me how to reach people. But if I don't have the heart of Jesus that yearns to meet with people, it all goes for loss. In fact, for most of my life, I would just hear the twice a year evangelism sermon and shrink in the pew until it was over and then forget about it because I was not like Jesus and I need to be like Jesus. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, for that reason, we've got to leave Luke 19 just a little bit. Each time we meet together, at least a few of these times together, we'll start with the character they're studying, then we'll move off of it a bit. I want you to go back to Luke 15. Luke chapter 15, there are three stories, and this is the center point of the remainder of our time tonight. In Luke 15, I want you to note in verses 1 and 2 that it's really the exact same setting. No Zacchaeus, but the other two characters are there. Jesus is there, and the Pharisees and the scribes who have elevated themselves above others. In Luke 15, look at verses 1 and 2. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were coming near to Jesus to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Now that's your setting. Jesus went to them sometimes, sometimes they came to him. Sometimes you'll go have a conversation with a guy in the park, and sometimes somebody will walk right through the front door of your church building. It works both ways. But either way, the scribes don't like it. It's messy, it's troubled and inconvenient, and it threatens sort of the perfect thing that we've built with these imperfect tax collectors and sinners. They've completely missed the point, and Jesus is about to show them that. So he tells three stories. All right, everybody here probably knows the three stories. We have the lost sheep and the lost coin and then the prodigal son, the lost son. I'm kind of a math nerd, so I always looked at it like 1% of your sheep, and then he goes up to 10% of your coins and then 50% of your kids. Because he's kind of making it where like anybody can see that. Like you lose one of your children, you would certainly react. But the point of them all is really easy to see, and I want to start with that. Look in verse 7. We'll read the stories in a moment, but look at verse 7. This is the heart of Jesus in a form that we can all understand. I tell you, this is after the story of the sheep, that in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. All right, you get that again in verse 10. It's worded a little bit differently, and then we'll read it in a minute. You actually get to hear the Father kind of say it, and that's kind of cool. But I'm asking you to just stare at verse 7. Do you believe what Jesus just said? Do you really believe it? Do you believe that there is more exuberation and rejoicing and tears and celebration in heaven over one Zacchaeus in a tree than over 100 saved people doing saved people things? Because that's what he just said. But you know what that means, right? I know. I was raised in the church. I know. We pride ourselves very, very strongly on being at church, right? Do we have some churchers up here in North Carolina? You guys are still in the South. I'm not going to make that mistake, but you're like Northern South to me. We go to church. We worship. We worship faithfully. We worship the right way. And we stay consistent in the way. All good. Okay, you're not going to hear me talk against any of that. But do you understand that you can attend services every Sunday and Wednesday for a straight year, and God's going to smile every time you do it, but that he would get more joy out of you reaching one lost soul than all of the effort you put into worship this coming Sunday? I mean, do we like get that? Because if we did, we would still love to worship. We would still be at worship. It's still important. We do that because we're saved. We worship. But we would understand that Jesus' heart is yearning for more than this. And again, I know, I was raised in the church. We really take a lot of pride in this. And I don't mean that negatively. I just mean that maybe we are majoring in something where Jesus says there's actually something a little bit more major than that. And it's the reaching of a soul. We'll get back to it later in the weekend when we study Matthew 25. Matt, you'll lose sleep over Matthew 25 when Jesus talks about the value of a soul. Now, as we get into these stories, he's going to show this to us. So I want to get into the three and read them in the time that we have remaining. And again, you've got the sheep and the coin and the son. And most of us study the prodigal son. That's kind of the big one. I'm going to tell you right now that the most impactful of the three stories to me is the very first one. The one about one sheep out of 100. Let's read it together and let's see if we can figure out the heart of Jesus. In verse 3, here's what the Bible says. Luke 15, verse 3. Jesus says, he told them this parable and here's what he said. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I found my sheep which was lost. I tell you, again, in the same way, there'll be more joy in heaven over that than over the 99 who are still among the flock. Now, you know what I think is interesting about this story? That I don't think I would give him the answer he was looking for. If he said, Chris, wouldn't you, if you had 100 sheep and one ran away, wouldn't you leave the 99 and go across the plain into dangerous territory and save the one sheep? No. I mean, I'm not a shepherd, so be patient, but why? I've got 99 sheep and they're good sheep. They don't run away. Like, maybe it's his third or fourth time to run away. And every time I run after him, I put myself at risk. I put the 99 sheep at risk. No, and like, I don't know a lot about sheep. Are they like rabbits? Can they make more sheep? Like, can we just replace the sheep? And don't tell me this doesn't start to sound familiar. I'm not going to go after the heart. It's way out there. I'm going to put myself at risk. We'll just breed our own sheep and we'll train them not to go anywhere. And then we'll have this great group of sheep. And so this story hits me. And I'm working on it, but it's revealed to me that I am not nearly as like Jesus as I should be. I'm not like Jesus like I should be. Because Jesus would go after the one sheep, and I honestly don't think it would be worth the effort. Or at least there's been times in my life that I've shown that. I got a long way to go to be more like Jesus. And part of it is getting the focus off of the look at us and the I got to go after him. Now, I'll tell you this, if I did go get the sheep, maybe I'm underselling it. Maybe I would go get the sheep. But if I got the sheep, I would kick the sheep. And I would drive the sheep back. And I go, man, this, if I got to do this one more time. He goes and gets the sheep. And he puts the sheep on his shoulders. Dumb sheep. And he carries that sheep back and puts it back in the flock. And then he calls all of his buddies. I'll tell you what I'm less likely to do than go get the one sheep. I'm less likely to attend a party for a guy who went and got one sheep. Why is that such a big deal? It's just the same old thing over and over again. He said, here's what I did. I brought him back, and then I called all of my friends, and I said, come rejoice with me, for I found my sheep, which was lost. The first thing that I want you to ask yourself as we begin this weekend, maybe we're coming in hot, but we only got a few days, and I'm out of here. You'll probably never see me again. Is, are you like him? Because the love for the one, which, by the way, just a quick reminder, you are that one, aren't you? You're just one. And somebody sought you, and Jesus sought you, and some of you got some pretty checkered past where you're like, it's unbelievable that Jesus kept reaching for me, and he did. I need to be more like him because, and I think I'm going to talk about this in the invitation when they get back. I just found out I'm going to do that, and I'm going to open my mouth, and something's going to come out. But I think what we need to understand is that we are the agents of Jesus. Like if Jesus was actually here, something tells me he might go across the street somewhere and see somebody having a hard time and sit down and ask how he could help them. He's not here in that way, but like we are. We have to have a heart like Jesus because we are the agents of Jesus. In John 10, he talks about how he's the shepherd and he calls for them and they hear his voice. Well, we are his voice. Well, let me change that. I am his voice. You are his voice. This first story really hits me hard because I need to kind of reevaluate what I thought real, true righteousness is. And sometimes the way we measure it is not exactly the way that heaven is measuring it. And I want to measure things like God measures them. And he measures them one soul at a time. Something really cool about that, just a little side note, we've got to move on, but You might go home and pray for God to put that one soul in front of you, but don't be surprised tomorrow when he's or she is basically the first person that you see. And you're probably going to be like, God, this is amazing. Like, I prayed about this, and I thought, I think I've cared more about the worship thing than the soul, and I prayed. And if God could speak to you, he'd say, you know, that person's been in your life for a while now. Like, I was just waiting on you to wake up and decide that you want to carry on the beautiful mission of Jesus. I'm excited about it. I'm hard on myself, but I'm excited about what can happen. Now, as we go into this, he says, let me tell you a second story. And in this second story, he makes a couple of interesting changes. He goes from a shepherd who I think easily represents Jesus. Like, that's really simple to see. The first story is a Jesus story going after the sheep. He's the shepherd. So he changes it from a shepherd to a woman, and he goes from one of 100 sheep to her having 10 silver coins. Let's just read it. It says, "Or what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and her neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I found the coin which I had lost.' In the same way, I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels over one sinner who repents." At its surface, it's a simple story. He just kind of ratchets it up a little bit. And I used to kind of teach it this way. If you're not interested in going after 1% of your flock, what if you lost 10% of your savings? Okay, and you go, ooh, now that starts to hurt. So you'd actually put in some effort to go find. Some of you are like, it ain't that much, don't worry about it. But maybe you do have a lot. Like 10%, you go, okay, I would actually do that. I don't think that's really what he's doing here. I think the first story is the most potent story in terms of numbers, because it's at least like I've been. But I want to suggest something to you, and you can study some commentators at home, and we don't know each other well, but it's not important that you agree with me on this, only that you openly admit that I am correct. But this story has some interesting first century implications. Study this on your own. There's this concept in first century Jewish culture where when a man and a woman would wed, so she's a wife and there's a husband, that he would give her something kind of like a ring, except much more elaborate and visible than a ring. He would give her a necklace. And that necklace would have 10 silver coins or other ornate things on it. And it represented a lot more than a piece of jewelry. It represented their relationship, kind of like a ring does, I guess. I just noticed that I am not wearing one, so let's make sure Summer's not watching that. That's my wife. But anyway, we normally would wear it. She's going to be like, you need to find that. You need to sweep the house and find that before you get home. But to her, it would represent a lot. Like, this is her honor to him. Like, this shows that the completeness of our relationship. So if she loses one of these coins, in some historical context, she might be put away because she dishonored their relationship by losing the one thing that symbolized the completeness between them. So in that case, she loses one of those 10 coins. It is a serious issue. Things just got very serious, in other words, from the first story to the second. If he comes back, stick with me, husband, bride, Jesus, if he comes back and I don't have this complete representation of who we are to offer him, then I may be put away because of that. She sweeps the house. She lights every candle that she has, and she truly calls her friends and says, I was at great risk of total loss. Partial loss could have led to total loss, and now I have it, and they rejoice together. Now, just kind of a question for you guys. I think it's easy to figure out in the first story that the shepherd represents Jesus, at least in its fundamental case, because we read about that. And the third story, which you guys already know, that's not tough. I mean, the Father and the Son. I mean, the Father's God the Father. I mean, we get that. It's very easy to see. So if the shepherd is Jesus in story number one, and the Father is the Father, who is the woman? Anybody wonder about that? Let me rephrase. Who is the bride? Is that helping? Who is the bride of Christ? It is his church. He says, you want to talk about the group? You want to talk about the 99 sheep? Let's talk about them. Let's talk about my bride, my people. And you can think about this locally, like this church is kind of like a representation of the completeness of the bride of Christ. Or you can think church universal. It's okay in either way. But what if, stick with me, let's just talk about this local church where most of you attend. What if when one of our members fell away, it was like losing a coin? We're no longer complete. We are not who we were in Christ. We have lost a piece of ourselves. And more importantly, we've lost a piece of what you have given to us that represents the connection between us. If there's a family that hasn't come back from all the COVID stuff, like we are a 9-coin church and Jesus is a 10-coin gift giver. What if we looked at even one soul in this fellowship who is tired, drifting, discouraged? Oh, let me just read here. Faint, fallen, or lost. And we said, Jesus might come back. Jesus might come back and talk to me if I'm a shepherd of this church or a member of this church and say, you know, you are this beautiful, complete body that was growing. A piece of us fell away and you just wrote it off. I'm not ready for that. So I wonder how churches would change if even the most stubborn, even the weakest, even the one that takes the most worth, if that coin rolled away, we all lit our lamps and we went and we found that coin. And we expressed one-on-one love for that person. You know, it might be that an eldership, I was thinking about this earlier this week, maybe that there are three shepherds who serve here. Maybe they meet together and they say, you know, there's this family we haven't seen in a while. We need them back. Now, listen to my language. It's not they need to get back here. We're going to make that an 8-foot wall and only give them 3 steps. No, no, no. We need them back. They're part of us. We need them. So they call these two people here, and they call you guys into the elders' room, which was all like the principal's office, right? You go into the elders' room, and they sit you down, and you're like, what did we do? And they say, no, you didn't do anything. Listen, that family that we're missing, that coin that's rolled away into the corner, you happen to know them very well. Would you help us go get them? Because we're not who we need to be without them. Now, is there a limit where they won't come back? Sure, but go to Matthew 18 for a moment. Matthew 18. We're going to get a little bit of extra time in Matthew 18 in a couple of days. But we all know this passage really well. It's the commonly called, and I'm just using this term because I've used it before, the disfellowship passage. But it's not a disfellowship passage. Matthew 18 is not about disfellowship. It's about fellowship. It's about every possible thing we can do to restore that coin to this necklace. And so it ends with that. It ends with an impasse where there's no other choice. But read the text with me. If your brother sins, go. You can do it in your best bass voice. Go up on the mountain. You said you would. And you actually know this person, so it's not even a cold call. Go. Show him his fault. And Galatians 6 would add things like with humility and with gentleness. We're going to talk a lot about that before we're done here this weekend as well. Go and show him. And if he listens to you, you've won your brother. And if he doesn't listen to you, go get a couple more people who love him. Go get a couple of more people who see the value in what we're doing so that by the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses, you can confirm every fact. If he refuses to listen to them, get everybody together. Amen. We got to go. You guys even understand how many members of the church who've fallen away who actually want to come back? Do you know that? They're ashamed. They're embarrassed. They think that people will judge them. You're going, but we won't judge them. I know how you feel. I'm telling you what they think, because that's what matters here. They think they're unwelcome. You know why some feel that way? Because they've been gone for 6 months and nobody calls them. No one's knocked on their door. Look, you want to be a part of us? Be a part of us. If you don't, then don't. Yeah, why don't you try presenting 9 coins to Jesus when you could have easily gone out and recovered the 10? That's the soul and spirit of Jesus. And so he says, hey, church, let's go. And then, of course, if he refuses, if he rejects it, if the coin will not come back, then let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. But that's his choice, not yours. I think that'll preach a little bit. That's his choice. It's not yours. He didn't pick up anything in you that would drive him to that way of thinking. How many of you know that God is a qualifier, not a disqualifier? If God was a disqualifier, I'm looking at a bunch of good people who'd all be toast right along with me. If God was looking for a reason to kick you out, if he wanted to make this a 9-coin necklace and get rid of the weakest link, I'd be the first one gone. You probably wouldn't be far behind me. God's a qualifier because he loves every one. And Jesus died for every one. And maybe if we were less interested in building a great local church that's super solid and secure with all good people, and we understand that we're actually here for all people, We're actually here to bring in the hurting. Maybe it would have changed the way we interact with folks. I'm just telling you that I need to become more like Jesus. And I think as a church, there's a culture to that. I hope that word doesn't hit you wrong. I use the word culture a lot. People don't like it. It's a business term. Every church has a culture. I can tell you more about it. Do I have time? I have a couple of minutes. Somebody comes and visits this church for a month. They come to all your classes. They do all the stuff with you. After they've been here for a month, if they think about joining and the things that they say they feel like they would have to do if they joined, that's your culture. Like, well, if I joined that church, we'd have to open up our homes. You know why they said that? Because you have a hospitality culture. You see? Like they would go, if we join that church, we would have to go hand out cards every month and invite people to church because that's what the preacher won't shut up about. Because that's the culture of that church is we hand out 5 cards a month to invite people to services. If it's, I might have to go have some uncomfortable conversations with people and kind of like beg them to come back, then that's the culture of our church. Like, what's the culture of this church? I just got here. I'm not picking on anybody. I just got here. I'm just saying that I have this sense of how Jesus would renovate us in our local churches. And he might tell us this story to do it. Now that brings us back to our last story, the one that we know really well. So let's head back over to that. We're in Luke chapter 15, and he gets to the son. And of course, there's a lot of focus. This is a lot like the Zacchaeus story, actually. It's pretty much just like the Zacchaeus story, in that Zacchaeus had drifted off into sinfulness. And while there are details about the prodigal son, my words to you tonight is that this story really isn't about the prodigal son. It's just about painting this really dark, desperate picture of a super ignorant person. It's really about the contrast between the father and who? The other brother. Now, who's the other brother in the story? They're the scribes and Pharisees that were griping because Jesus went to Zacchaeus' house. And they're also the ones who complained to open this chapter. So let's read a little bit about it. He starts with this in verse 11. He said, a man had 2 sons, and the younger one said, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. And you know the rest. The boy, not many days later, he took everything and went on a journey and he blew it all. Then verses 17 through 19, we talk about a lot because I think we sometimes see this as the centerpiece of the story. I'm not convinced it is the centerpiece, but it's good. He comes to his senses, verse 17. He says, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I'm dying here with hunger. I'll get up and go to my father. I'll say to him, and he rehearses this speech, you know, Father, I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired men. And again, if this was like a Sunday morning of a gospel meeting, we had a lot of people from the community here and people who are kind of maybe weaker in their faith or wandering, you know, not the A-list, not the Friday nighters like you, I'd preach on that guy. I'd go, hey, you know what? If you're weak and drifting, like, you need to come to your senses and you need to come back to the Father and you need to fall into his arms. But just like the Zacchaeus story, I don't want to talk about Zacchaeus. I want to talk about God. So I'm not going to ask you, are you like the prodigal son? I'm going to ask you, are you like the father? Let's read the story. So he gets up and he comes to his father. But while he was a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven. I've sinned in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And he doesn't get to say anymore. Here's how I picture this. He's ready to give this big old speech. I'll pay back 4 times what I had, the whole Zacchaeus speech. Like, he's ready to, I'll pay it back and I'll work in the pigsty. And the father's like, shh, stop. The very fact that you have come home is all that you've ever been required to do. Stops him there. He says, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. The father said to us, she's like, shh, stop. Slaves, quickly bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand. Put sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf. Kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and he has been found. And they began to celebrate. Folks, that's how you become an evangelistic body of believers. That's how you do it. No obstacles. No, I mean, everybody needs to be baptized into Christ, but they have to be people who see love and experience love and understand that it's going to be okay. And they don't have to make restitution for all of their past sins. They just have to want God. And there you are saying, that's all that's needed. And you embrace them and you welcome them and you lead them into the water or back to the faith. I'm going to talk a little bit about this throughout the weekend, but back home, there's this this mission in Tyler, which is about 20 minutes from where I live. And it's a rehab facility for drug addicts, for men who voluntarily go in. They have to be clean when they go in, and they have to stay clean in the program. And they go in. There's about 35 of them at any given time. But one of the guys at our church was like, what are we doing to reach out to the community? And we're like, we live stream, I guess, you know. And he's like, no. He said, I'm going to go find some people who are hurting, who've messed up everything, who've been in the pigsty, and I'm going to see where they are. So he started teaching that little place. And all of a sudden on a Tuesday night, there's a baptism. And then Thursday night, there's a baptism. And then there were two more, and then four more. He baptized 16 of these guys. And six of them have started to come to our church. And there's kind of two stories I want to tell you about that. First of all, and it got us started, and they come over to the house now, and we've all kind of renovated. But it's interesting how kind of cautious we all were at first. Like, going to those guys and doing, these are the broken men. These are the men who have no one to love them. They're in the pigsty. They've blown it. Every relationship they've ever had. He went to them and they started being baptized over and over again. But then what was interesting is six of them joined our fellowship, local. And then the next week, none of them showed up again. And I asked the guy who picked them up, I said, why wouldn't they come? And he said, Chris, I'm just going to give it to you straight. They feel completely worthless. They feel unlovable. They don't believe that they will ever fit in at our church. They've done too much. You know how many people feel that? You don't have to be a drug addict to feel that. And man, let me tell you, that changed the culture of the Lyndale Church. It's our job to put the best robe on them, to put them at the head of the table. And by the way, at kitchen tables, in your actual house, they got to know they matter. They matter more. You say, well, do they matter more? Can I take you back? I rejoice in heaven more over one soul who repents than over 99 who I've already rejoiced over. I've already rejoiced over you. We have got to become a people like the Father who express this spirit. We'll call it missions of mercy. How's that? What a wonderful extension of mercy he was given. Now, what's interesting about this story is the end of it, where we get into the other son. And you know who the other son is in the text. The other son are those scribes and Pharisees. They've got their synagogues. They've got their worship. They've got their rules. And you know, Pharisees were legalistic, but not always in a bad way. Like, they just wanted to follow the rules. They thought that if they messed up even one rule, God would strike them dead. And I can understand that. So they were very much focused on the law and the rules and being right. The problem was Jesus was focused on souls, and they were focused on self. And that's a very different thing. And you're going to see it in this story. Now, the older one is in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants, and he began inquiring what's going on. And he said to him, your brother has come. Your father's killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound. But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. I mean, think about that. He's pleading with him to come in. But he answered and said to his father, look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you've never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, not my brother, this son of yours, who has devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf, he did the worst, and you gave him the best. He did the worst. You gave him the best? He said to him, son, you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. We had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live and was lost and has been found. No matter what, we cannot be that guy. We're at risk a little bit. I'm at risk a little bit. I'm in the synagogue. I'm a part of the worship. All good. I'm in the in crowd. We've got something to protect here, and we very well may see that there are those who can hurt our group. We have like this leaven of the lump concept, but the leaven were impenitent people, people who weren't seeking, not those who were. I'm going to show you, as we get to the end of this study, I'm going to show you two mistakes that the elder brother made that we can't make. So let's put it that way. There's two mistakes that we can't make. First of all, I'm a big pronoun guy. I'm always studying pronouns. When I'm talking to somebody, I'm kind of counting up my pronouns, like how many I's, how many U's. Listen to conversations. I talk about me bubbles sometimes. You know, people in me bubbles is like all about me, 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 I. Have you ever watched two me bubblers have a conversation? It's kind of funny. It's not really a conversation. It's just like, my family, my house, my kids, mine. And the other one's like, are you done? Well, me, my, mine, and my better house, blah, 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 blah. And then they just go, they're like monologuing at each other inside the bubble. I've often wanted to just walk around with a $100 bill in my pocket. And like the first one who asks a follow-up question, like goes, hey, that's interesting. Tell me more about that. I'm just going to go like, dude, here. Like, go get yourself a nice dinner. Because it's just kind of like our tendency to process everything around us based on who? Like us, like me. I mean, and it's not easy because did you know that you are at the center of every experience you've ever had? Are you aware of that? Everything you've ever seen, everything you've ever done, everything you've ever felt, it was sourced in you. And so there's this idea of this son going, look, I'm just looking at this from my perspective. And he does not deserve honor. And he should be paying the price. And I do deserve honor. Now, I'm a pronoun guy, so look at verse 29 and it gives it all away. It gives it all away. He answered to his father and he said, look. And you can circle these. I'm a big Bible marker. I've circled these. For so many years, I have been serving you. I have never neglected a command of yours, and yet you've never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. Jesus said, we throw the party for the one sheep, not for the 99. I mean, didn't it literally say that in the first story? This guy is caring about himself, folks. For so long as the focus is on me and what it means for me and how comfortable I am with it and how clean it has to be, for the extent that it's on me, I'm just not like Jesus. That's really what it boils down to. For Jesus, it was always about it. It was so about everyone else that he let the people he came to save kill him, and he begged for their forgiveness while he was dying. It was never about Jesus to him. That's the first mistake this guy made, and we've got to be careful about that. But you know, the second one, and we've already kind of mentioned it, is he is comparing himself to who? Who is the older brother comparing himself to? The bad brother. I'm the good one, he's the bad one. I'm the one who should be here, not sure whether he should be here. Let me give you another parable. I'm the one who worked all day. This guy's just going to sneak back in at 5 o'clock and get a whole day's wage? I do not think so. He's comparing himself to the brother. Here's my bigger question, though. Instead of comparing himself to the one that's hurting and at the lowest point, who should the brother have been comparing himself to in that moment? Anybody know? He should have been comparing himself to his dad. I'm over here thinking about me. I'm over here wondering what it's going to mean for me. You're over here. He spent half your money. He wasted. This is how he should have been. He spent half of your whole fortune on prostitutes. And you put the robe on him? You actually ran to him? And by the way, I didn't say this. We're almost out of time. But I think we have this mentality. We're just going to stand here like this. And if you want to come back, you know where we go to church. You know my phone number. Jesus went all the way out to get the sheep. And as soon as the father saw the first inclination of hope, he took off running. You went off running for him. You threw a party. Father, I'm nothing like you. Help me be more like you. That's our plea. That's what our prayer life needs to be. Help me be more like Jesus. So let's go back to the first story and finish where we started. You want to be more like Jesus? Listen to this. What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the field and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? He goes to find it. When he finds it, he lifts it up on his shoulders. He rejoices with it. He comes home. He gathers everybody else up, and he celebrates the one who was lost, who is found again. When that becomes our culture, when that becomes our attitude, when that becomes our heart, there is no limit to how many people can be saved. There's no limit. We got to tear down the wall and go get the people. Just like Jesus did when he said, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to your house because salvation has come to you today. I wonder who in your life will be able to say soon that because of something you chose to do, because of a conversation you had, because of something you said, that salvation came to their house too. It looked a lot like you because you looked a lot like Jesus. I'm ready to grow. We're going to work on it all weekend. But this is where it begins, right here. Thank you guys for your good attention.